gathering himself and trying to calm his voice. "It will be all right. Don't cry. Eldon will watch over you. Let him know what happened. It'll be all right." She continued to sob. "Please, honey, you have to go inside now." Wyatt pleaded. "It's all you can do. It's what I need you to do. Please."
"I love you, Daddy."
"I know, honey, I know. I love you too, and I'm so sorry." Ali slowly stepped back into the doorway, the sliver of light diminishing until the door snapped shut, leaving the alley once more in darkness. Only the faint blue light from the cloud-shrouded moon filtered into the narrow corridor where the three men stood.
"How old is she?"
the voice behind him asked.
"Leave her out of this. Just make it quick. Can you give me that much?"
Wyatt braced himself for what was to come. Seeing the child had broken him. He shook violently, his gloved hands in fists, his chest so tight it was difficult to swallow and hard to breathe. He felt the metal edge against his throat and waited for it to move, waited for it to drag.
"Did you know it was a trap when you came to hire us?"
the man with three swords asked.
"What? No."
"Would you still have done it if you knew?"
"I don't know. I guess, yes, we needed the money."
"So, you're not a baron?"
"No."
"What then?"
"I was a ship's captain."
"Was? What happened?"
"Are you going to kill me any time soon? Why all the questions?"
"Each question you answer is another breath you take,"
the voice from behind him spoke. It was the voice of death, emotionless and empty. Hearing it made Wyatt's stomach lurch as if he were looking over the edge of a high cliff. Not seeing his face, knowing that he held the blade that would kill him, made it feel like an execution. He thought of Ali, hoped she would be all right, then realized she would see him. The thought struck with surprising clarity. She would rush out after it was over and find him on the street. She would wade through his blood.
"What happened?"
the executioner asked again, his voice instantly erasing all other thoughts.
"I sold my ship."
"Why?"
"It doesn't matter."
"Gambling debts?"
"No."
"Why then?"
"What difference does it make? You're going to kill me anyway. Just do it."
He had steadied himself. He was ready. He clenched his teeth, shut his eyes. Still the killer delayed.
"It makes a difference," the executioner whispered in his ear, "because Ali is not your daughter."
The blade came away from Wyatt's neck. Slowly, hesitantly, Wyatt turned to face the man holding the dagger. He had never seen him before. He was smaller than his partner, dressed in a black cloak with a hood that shaded his features, revealing only hints of a face, the tip of a sharp nose, highlight of a cheek, end of a chin.
"How do you know that?"
"She saw us in the dark. She saw my knife at your throat as we stood deep in shadow across the length of 20 yards.
Wyatt said nothing. He did not dare move or speak. He didn't know what to think. Somehow, something had changed. The certainty of death rolled back a step, but its shadow lingered. He had no idea what was happening and was terrified of making a misstep.
"You sold your ship to buy her, didn't you?"
the hooded man guessed. "But from whom? And why?" Wyatt stared at the face beneath the hood, a bleak landscape, a desert dry of compassion.
Death was there, a mere breath away. An utterance remained all that separated eternity from salvation. The bigger man, the one with three swords, reached out and placed a hand on his shoulder.
A lot is riding on your answer. But you already knew that, didn't you? Right now, you're trying to decide what to say. And of course, you're trying to guess what we want to hear. Don't. Go with the truth. At least that way, if you're wrong, your death won't have been because of a lie.
Wyatt nodded. He closed his eyes again, took a deep breath and said,
I bought her from a man named Ambrose.
Ambrose Moore? The executioner asked.
Yes.
Wyatt waited, but nothing happened. He opened his eyes. The dagger was gone, and the three-sword man was smiling at him.
I don't know how much that little girl cost, but it was the best money you ever spent.
You aren't going to kill me?
Not today.
You still owe us 100 tenants for the balance on that job, the man in the hood told him coldly.
I don't have it.
Get it.
Lights burst into the alley as the door to Wyatt's loft flew open with a bang, and Eldon charged out. He held his mammoth, two-headed axe high above his head as he strode toward them with a determined look. The man, with three swords, rapidly drew two of them.
Eldon, no! Wyatt shouted. They're not going to kill me, just stop!
Eldon paused, his axe held aloft, his eyes looking back and forth between them.
They're letting me go,
Wyatt assured him, then turned to the two men.
You are, aren't you?
The hooded man nodded.
Pay off that debt.
As the men walked away, Eldon moved to Wyatt's side and Ali ran out to hug him. The three returned to the loft and slipped inside the doorway. Eldon took one last look around, then closed the door behind them.
Did you see the size of that guy?
Hadrian asked Royce, still glancing over his shoulder, as if the giant might try to sneak up on them.
I've never seen anyone that big. He had to be a good 7 feet tall. And that neck, those shoulders, and that axe. It would take two of me just to lift it. Maybe he isn't human. Maybe he's a giant or a troll. Some people swear they exist. I've met a few who say they've seen them personally.
Royce looked at his friend and scowled.
Okay, so it's mostly drunks in bars who say that, but that doesn't mean it's not possible. Ask Myron. He'll back me up.
The two headed north toward the Langdon Bridge. It was quiet here. In the respectable hill district of Colnora, people were more inclined to sleep at night than to carouse in taverns. This was the home of merchant titans, affluent businessmen who owned houses grander than many of the palatial mansions of upper nobility. Colnora had started out as a meagre rest stop at an intersection of the Westbaden and Equesta trade routes. Originally, a farmer named Hollenbeck and his wife had watered caravans there, and granted room in their barn to the traders in return for news and goods. Hollenbeck had an eye for quality and always picked the best of the lot. Soon his farm became an inn, and Hollenbeck added a store and a warehouse to sell what he acquired to passing travellers. The merchants, deprived of first pick, bought plots next to his farm, and opened their own shops, taverns, and roadhouses. The farm became a village, then a city, but still the caravans gave preference to Hollenbeck. Legend held that the reason was their fondness for his wife, a wonderful woman who, in addition to being uncommonly beautiful, sang and played the mandolin. It was said she baked the finest cobblers of peach, blueberry, and apple. Centuries later, when no one could accurately place the location of the original Hollenbeck farm, and few remembered there had ever been such a farmer, they continued to remember his wife, Colnora. Over the years, the city flourished, until it became the largest urban centre in Avon. Shoppers found the latest style in clothes, the most exquisite jewellery, and the widest variety of exotic spices from hundreds of shops and marketplaces.
In addition, the city was home to some of the best artisans and boasted the finest, most popular inns and taverns in the country. Entertainers had long congregated there, prompting Cosmos Delure, the city's wealthiest resident and patron of the arts, to construct the Delure Theatre. Crossing the district, Royce and Hadrian halted abruptly in front of the theatre's large white-painted board. It depicted the silhouette of two men scaling the outside of a castle tower, and read, "The Crown Conspiracy! How a Young Prince and Two Thieves Saved a Kingdom!" Evening Shows Daily. Royce raised an eyebrow, while Hadrian slipped the tip of his tongue along the front of his teeth. They glanced at each other, but neither said a word, before continuing on their way. Leaving the Hill District, they continued along Bridge Street, as the land sloped downward toward the river. They passed rows of warehouses, mammoth buildings emblazoned with company brands like Royal Crests. Some were simply initials, usually the new businesses that had no sense of themselves. Others bore trademarks, like the boar's head of the Bocant Company, an empire whose genesis had been pork, or the diamond symbol of Delure Enterprises.
"You realize he'll never be able to pay us the 100?" Hadrian asked.
"I just didn't want him to think he was getting off easy."
"You didn't want him to think Royce Melbourne went soft at the sight of a little girl's tears?"
"She wasn't just any girl. And besides, he saved her from Ambrose Moore. For that alone he earned one life."
"That's something that's always puzzled me. How is it Ambrose is still alive?"
"I've been sidetracked, I suppose," Royce said in his "let's not talk about it" tone, and Hadrian dropped the subject.
Of the city's three main bridges, the Langdon was the most ornate. Made from cut stone, it was lined every few feet by large lampposts fashioned in the shapes of swans, which, when lit, gave the bridge a festive look. Now, however, with the lights out, the stone was wet and appeared oily and dangerous.
"Well, at least we didn't spend the last month looking for DeWitt for nothing," Hadrian said sarcastically as they crossed the bridge. "I would have thought..."
Royce stopped walking and abruptly raised his hand. Both men looked around and, without a word, drew their weapons as they moved back to back. Nothing seemed amiss. The only sound was the roar of the tumultuous waters that rushed and churned below them.
"Impressive, Duster,"
a man said, addressing Royce as he stepped out from behind one of the bridge lampposts. His skin was pale and his body so slender and bony that he swam in his loose breeches and shirt. He looked like a corpse someone forgot to bury. Behind them, Hadrian noted three more men crawling onto the span. They all had similar appearances, thin and muscular, each in dark-coloured clothes. They circled like wolves.
"What tipped you off we were here?" the thin man asked.
"I'm guessing it was your breath, but body odour really can't be ruled out,"
Hadrian replied with a grin, while noting their positions, their movements, and the direction of their eyes.
"Mind your mouth, bub,"
the tallest of the four threatened.
"To what do we owe this visit, Price?" Royce asked.
"Funny. I was about to ask you the same," the thin man replied. "This is our city, after all. Not yours.
Not any more."
"Black Diamond?"
Hadrian asked. Royce nodded.
"And you would be Hadrian Blackwater,"
Price noted.
"I always thought you'd be bigger."
"And you're a Black Diamond. I always thought there were more of you."
Price smiled, held his gaze long enough to suggest a threat, and returned his attention to Royce.
"So, what are you doing here, Duster?"
"Just passing through."
"Really? No business?"
"Nothing that would interest you."
"Well now, you see, that's where you're wrong."
Price stepped away from the swan lamppost and began slowly circling them as he talked. The wind, blowing down the river, whipped his loose shirt like a flag at mast.
"The Black Diamond is interested in everything that happens in Colnora, most particularly when it involves you, Duster."
Hadrian leaned over and asked,
"Why does he keep calling you Duster?"
"That was my guild name," Royce replied.
"He was a Black Diamond?"
asked the youngest looking of the four. He had round, chubby cheeks, blown red and blotchy, and a narrow mouth, wreathed by a thin moustache and goatee.
"Oh, yes, that's right, Etcher. You've never heard of Duster before, have you?"
"Etcher is new to the guild. Only been with us, what, 6 months?"
"Well, you see, not only was Duster a diamond, he was an officer, bucket man, and one of the most notorious members in the guild's history."
"Bucket man?"
Hadrian asked.
"Assassin," Royce explained.
"He's a legend, this one is,"
Price went on, pacing around the stone bridge, carefully avoiding the puddles.
"Wonder boy of his day. He rose through the ranks so fast, it unnerved people."
"Funny," Royce said. "I only remember one."
"Well, when the first officer of the guild is nervous, so is everyone else. You see, back then, the duel had a man named Hoyt running the show. He was an arse to most of us. A good thief and administrator, but an arse just the same. Duster here had a lot of support from the lower ranks, and Hoyt was concerned Duster might replace him. He began ordering Duster on the most dangerous jobs. Jobs that went suspiciously bad. Still, Duster always escaped unscathed, making him even more a hero. Rumours began circulating we might have a traitor in the guild. Rather than being concerned, Hoyt saw this as an opportunity."
Price paused in his orator's trek around the bridge and stopped in front of Royce.
"You see, at that time there were three bucket men in the guild, and all of them good friends. Jade, the guild's only female assassin, was a beauty who..."
"Is this going somewhere, Price?" Royce snapped.
"Just giving Etcher a little background, Duster. You wouldn't begrudge me the chance to educate my boys, would you?"
Price smiled and returned to his casual pacing, slipping his thumbs into the loose waistline of his pants.
"Where was I? Oh, yes, Jade. It happened right over there."
He pointed back across the bridge.
"That empty warehouse with the clover symbol on its side. That's where Hoyt set them up, pitting one against the other. Then, like now, bucket men wore masks to prevent being marked."
Price paused and looked at Royce with feigned sympathy.
"You had no idea who she was until it was over, did you, Duster? Or did you know and kill her anyway?"
Royce said nothing, but glared at Price with a dangerous look.
"The last of the three bucket men was Cutter, who was understandably upset to learn Duster murdered Jade, since Cutter and Jade were lovers. The fact that his friend was responsible made it personal, and Hoyt was happy to let Cutter settle the score. But Cutter didn't want Duster dead. He wanted him to suffer, and insisted on something more elaborate, more painful. The man is a strategic mastermind, our best heist planner, and arranged for Duster to be apprehended by the city guard. Cutter traded a few favours and, with some money, bought a trial that resulted in Duster going to Manzant prison. The hole no one ever comes back from. Escape was thought to be impossible. Only somehow Duster managed it. You know, we still don't know how you got out."
He paused, giving Royce a chance to reply. Again, Royce remained silent. Price shrugged.
When Duster escaped, he returned to Culnora. First, the magistrate who presided over his trial was found dead in his bed. Then, the false witnesses, all three on the same night, and finally, the lawyer. Soon, one by one, members of the Black Diamond started disappearing. They turned up in the strangest places, the river, the city square, even the steeple of the church. After losing more than a dozen members, the Jewel made a deal. He gave Hoyt to Duster, who forced him to confess publicly. Then Duster killed Hoyt and left his body in the Hill Square fountain. It was pure artistry. It stopped the war, but the wounds were too deep to forgive. Duster left, only to re-emerge years later, working out of Crimson Hand territory up north. But you're not a member, are you?
I don't have much use for guilds anymore, Royce replied coldly.
And who's that?
Etcher asked, pointing at Hadrian.
Duster's servant. He's carrying enough weapons for the both of them.
Price smiled at Etcher.
That's Hadrian Blackwater, and I wouldn't point at him. You're likely to lose that arm.
Etcher looked at Hadrian skeptically.
What? He's some kind of master swordsman, is that it?
Price chuckled.
Sword, spear, arrow, rock, whatever is at hand.
He turned to Hadrian.
The Diamond doesn't know as much about you, but there are a lot of rumours. One says you were a gladiator. Another reports you were a general in the Calaean army. Successful, too, if the stories can be trusted. There's even one tale circulating that you were the enslaved courtier of an exotic eastern queen.
Some of the other Diamonds, including Etcher, chuckled.
As much fun as this trip down memory lane has been, Price, do you have any reason for stopping us?
You mean beyond entertainment? Beyond harassment? Beyond reminding you that this is a Black Diamond-controlled city? Beyond informing you that ungilded thieves like yourselves are not allowed to practice here, and that you personally are not welcome?
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Actually, there is one more thing. There's a girl looking for you two.
Royce and Hadrian glanced at each other curiously.
She's been going around asking about two thieves named Hadrian and Royce. Now, as entertaining as it has been to hear your names publicly advertised, it's embarrassing for the Black Diamond to have anyone asking for thieves in Culnora that are not members of our guild. People are apt to get the wrong impression about this city.
Who is she? Royce asked.
No idea.
Where is she?
Sleeping under the Tradesman's Arch on Capitol Boulevard, so I think we can rule out her being a noble debutante or a rich merchant's daughter. Since she is travelling alone, I think you can also rule out the possibility that she's here to kill you or have you arrested. If I had to guess, I should think she's looking to hire you. I must say, if she is typical of the kind of patrons you two attract, I would consider a more traditional line of work. Perhaps there's a pig farm you might be able to get a job at. At least you would be keeping the same level of company.
Price's tone and expression dropped to a serious level.
Find her, and get her, and yourselves, out of our city by tomorrow night. You might want to hurry. Cleaned up, she could be pretty and might fetch a fair price, or at least provide several minutes of pleasure for someone. I suspect the only reason she hasn't been touched so far is that she's been dropping your names everywhere. Around here, Royce Melbourne is still something of a boogeyman.
Price turned to leave, and his mocking tone returned.
It's actually a shame you can't stay around. The theatre is showing a play about a couple of thieves lured into being accused of murdering the King of Medford. It's loosely based on the real murder of Amrath several years ago.
Price shook his head.
Completely unrealistic.
Can you imagine a seasoned thief being lured into a castle to steal a sword to save a man from a duel? Orpheus.
Price continued to shake his head as he and the other thieves left Hadrian and Royce on the bridge and headed down the streets on the far bank.
Well, that was pleasant, don't you think?
Hadrian said as they retraced their steps, heading back up the hill toward Capitol Boulevard.
Nice bunch of guys. I feel a little disappointed they only sent four.
Trust me, they were plenty dangerous. Price is the Diamond's first officer, and the other two quiet ones were bucket men. There were also six more, three on each side of the bridge, hiding under the ambush lip. Just in case. They weren't taking any chances with us. Does that make you feel better?
Much thanks.
Hadrian rolled his eyes.
Duster, huh?
Don't call me that, Royce said, his tone serious. Don't ever call me that.
Call you what?
Hadrian asked innocently. Royce sighed, then smiled at him.
Walk faster. Apparently, we have a client waiting.
She awoke to a rough hand on her thigh.
What you got in the purse, honey?
Disoriented and confused, the girl wiped her eyes. She was in the gutter beneath the tradesman's arch. Her hair was a filthy tangle of leaves and twigs, her dress a tattered rag. She clutched a tiny purse to her chest, the drawstring tied around her neck. To most passing by, she might appear as a bundle of trash discarded on the side of the road, or a pile of cloth and twigs absently left behind by the street sweepers. Still, there were those who were interested even in piles of trash. The first thing she saw when her eyes could focus was the dark, haggard face and gaping mouth of a man crouching over her. She squealed and tried to crawl away. A hand grabbed her by the hair. Strong arms forced her down, pinning her wrists to her sides. She felt his hot breath on her face, and it smelled of liquor and smoke. He tore the tiny purse from her fingers and pulled it from around her neck.
No!
She wrenched a hand free and reached out for it.
I need that!
So do I!
The man cackled, slapping her hand aside. Feeling the weight of coins in the bag, he smiled and stuffed the small pouch in his breast pocket.
No!
She protested. He sat on her, pinning her to the ground, and ran his fingers down her face, along her lips, stopping at her neck. Slowly they circled her throat, and he gave a little squeeze. She gasped, struggling to breathe. He pressed his lips hard against hers, so hard she could tell he was missing teeth. The rough stubble of his whiskers scratched her chin and cheeks.
"Shush," he whispered. "We're only getting started. You need to save your strength."
He lifted off, pushing himself up to his knees, and reached for the buttons of his breeches. She struggled, clawing at him, kicking. He pinned her arms under his knees, and her feet found only air. She screamed. The man replied by slapping her hard across the face. The shock left her stunned, staring blindly, while he returned to work on his buttons. The pain didn't hit her yet, not fully. It was there, welling up, fire hot on her cheek. Through watering eyes, she saw him on top of her, as if viewing the scene from a distance. Individual sounds were lost, replaced by a dull hum. She saw his cracked, peeling lips moving, his throat muscles shifting, long, gangly cords, but never heard the words. She freed one arm, but it was captured and stuffed back down out of sight once more. Behind him, she could see two figures approaching. Somewhere inside her, a thread of hope came alive, and she managed a weak whisper.
"Help me!"
The foremost man drew a massive sword and, holding it by the blade, swung the pommel. Her attacker fell, sprawling across the gutter. The man with the sword knelt down beside her. He was merely an outline against the charcoal sky, a phantom in the dark.
May I be of assistance, m'lady?
She heard his voice. A nice voice. His hand found hers, and he pulled her to her feet.
Who are you?
My name is Hadrian Blackwater.
She stared at him.
Really?
She managed, refusing to let go of his hands. Before she realized it, she began to cry.
What did you do to her?
The other man asked, coming up behind them.
I don't know.
Are you squeezing her hand too hard?
Let her go.
I'm not holding her, she's holding me.
I'm sorry.
Her voice quavered. I just never thought I would ever find you.
Oh, okay. Well, you did.
He smiled at her.
And this fellow here is Royce Melbourne.
She gasped and threw her arms around the smaller man's neck, hugging him tight and crying even harder. Royce stood awkward and stiff while Hadrian peeled her off.
So, I get the impression you're glad to see us.
That's good,
Hadrian told her.
Now, who are you?
I'm Thrace Wood of Dahlgren Village.
She was smiling. She couldn't help herself.
I've been looking for you for a very long time.
She staggered.
Are you all right?
I'm a little dizzy.
When was the last time you had anything to eat?
Thrace stood thinking, her eyes shifting back and forth as she tried to remember.
Never mind.
Hadrian turned to Royce.
This was once your city. Any ideas where we can get help for a young woman in the middle of the night?
It's a shame we aren't in Medford. Gwen would be great for this sort of thing.
Well, isn't there a brothel here?
After all, we're in the trade capital of the world. Don't tell me they don't sell that.
Yeah, there's a nice one on South Street.
Okay, Thrace is it? Come with us. We'll see if we can get you cleaned up and perhaps a bit of food in you.
Wait!
She knelt down beside the unconscious man and pulled her purse from his pocket.
Is he dead?
She asked.
Doubt it. Didn't hit him that hard.
Rising, she felt light-headed, and darkness crept in from the edges of her vision. She hovered a moment like a drunk, began to sway, and finally collapsed. She woke only briefly, and felt arms gently lifting her. Through a dull buzzing, she heard the sound of a chuckle.
"What's so funny?"
she heard one of them say. "This is the first time, I suspect, anyone has ever visited a whorehouse and brought his own woman." Chapter 2 Thrace
"Shines up purty as a new copper piece, that one does," Clarice noted, as the three looked through the doorway at Thrace waiting in the parlour. Clarice was a large, rotund woman with rosy cheeks and short, pudgy fingers that had a habit of playing with the pleats of her skirt. She and the other women of the bawdy bottom brothel had done wonders with the girl. Thrace was clothed in a new dress. It was cheap and simple, a brown linen kirtle over a white smock with the starched brown bodice, but still decidedly more fetching than the rag she had worn. She hardly resembled the ragamuffin they had met the night before. In addition to giving her a bed to sleep in, the women had scrubbed, combed, and fed her. Her lips and eyes were even painted, and the results were stunning. She was a young beauty, with startling blue eyes and golden hair.
"Poor girl was in awful shape when you dropped her off. Where'd you find her?"
Clarice asked.
"Under the tradesman's arch," Hadrian replied.
"Poor thing."
The large woman shook her head sadly.
"You know, if she needs a place, I'm sure we could put her on the roster. She'd get a bed to sleep in, 3 meals a day, and with her look she could do well for herself."
"Something tells me she's not a prostitute," Hadrian told her.
"None of us are, honey. Not until you find yourself sleeping under the tradesman's arch, that is.
You should have seen her at breakfast. She ate like a starved dog."
Course she wouldn't touch a thing till we convinced her that the food was free, given by the Chamber of Commerce to visitors of the city as a welcome. Maggie came up with that one. She's a hoot, she is. That reminds me. The bill for the room, dress, food and general clean-up comes to 65 silver. We threw in the makeup for free 'cause Delia just wanted to see how she'd look, on account she says she's never worn it afore. Royce handed her a gold tenant. Well, well, you two really need to drop by more often. And next time without the girl, eh? She winked. Seriously, though, what's the story with this one? That's just it. We don't know, Hadrian replied. But I think it's time we found out, Royce added. Not nearly as nice as Medford House back home, the bawdy bottom brothel was decorated with gaudy red drapes, rickety furniture, pink lampshades and dozens of pillows. Everything had tassels and fringe, from the threadbare carpets to the cloth edging adorning the top of the walls. It was old, weathered and worn, but at least it was clean. The parlour was a small oval room, just off the main hall, with two bay windows that looked out on the street. It contained two love seats, a few tables crowded with ceramic figures, and a small fireplace. Seated on one of the love seats, Thrace waited, her eyes darting about as if she were a rabbit in an open field. The moment the two men entered, she leapt from her seat, knelt, and bowed her head. "Hey, watch it, that's a new dress," Hadrian said with a smile.
"Oh!"
She scrambled to her feet, blushing, then curtsied and bowed her head once more.
"What's she doing?" Royce whispered to Hadrian. "Not sure," he whispered back. "I'm trying to show the proper reverence, your lordships," she whispered to both of them while keeping her head down. "I'm sorry if I'm not very good at it."
Royce rolled his eyes and Hadrian began to laugh.
"Why are you whispering?"
Hadrian asked her.
"Because you two were."
Hadrian chuckled again.
"Sorry, Thrace. Your name is Thrace, right?"
"Yes, my lord. Thrace Annabel Wood, of Dahlgren Village."
She awkwardly curtsied again.
"Okay, well, Thrace."
Hadrian struggled to continue with a straight face.
"Royce and I are not lords, so there's no need to bow or curtsy."
The girl looked up.
"You saved my life," she told them in such a solemn tone, Hadrian stopped laughing. "I don't remember a lot of last night, but I remember that much, and for that you deserve my gratitude."
"I would settle for an explanation," Royce said, moving to the windows. He began closing the drapes.
"Straighten up, for Maribor's sake, before a sweeper sees you, thinks we're noble, and marks us. We're already on thin ice here, as it is. Let's not add to it."
She stood up straight, and Hadrian couldn't help staring. Her long yellow hair, now free of twigs and leaves, shimmered in waves over her shoulders. She was a vision of youthful beauty, and Hadrian guessed she couldn't be more than 17.
"Now, why have you been looking for us?" Royce asked, closing the last curtain.
"To hire you to save my father," she said, untying the purse from around her neck and holding it up with a smile. "Here, I have 25 silver tenants, solid silver stamped with the Dunmore crown."
Royce and Hadrian exchanged looks.
"Isn't it enough?"
she asked, her lips starting to tremble.
"How long did it take you to save up this money?" Hadrian asked.
"All my life. I saved every copper I was ever given or earned. It was my dowry."
"Your dowry?"
She lowered her head, looking at her feet. "My father's a poor farmer. He would never..."
"I decided to save for myself. It's not enough, is it? I didn't realize. I'm from a very small village. I thought it was a lot of money. Everyone said so, but..."
She looked around at the battered love seat and faded curtains.
"We don't have palaces like this."
"Well, we really don't,"
Royce began in his usual insensitive tone.
"What Royce is about to say," Hadrian interrupted, "is we really don't know yet.
It depends on what you want us to do.
Thrace looked up, her eyes hopeful. Royce just glared at him.
Well, it does, doesn't it?
Hadrian shrugged.
Now, Thrace, you say you want us to save your father. Has he been kidnapped or something?
Oh, no. Nothing like that. As far as I know, he's fine. Although, I have been away a long time looking for you, so I'm not sure.
I don't understand. What do you need us for?
I need you to open a lock for me.
A lock?
To what?
A tower. You want us to break into a tower?
No. I mean, well, yes. But it isn't like... It's not illegal. The tower isn't occupied. It's been deserted for years. At least, I think so.
So, you just want us to open a door to an empty tower?
Yes,
she said, nodding vigorously so that her hair bounced.
Doesn't sound too hard.
Hadrian looked at Royce. Where is this tower? Royce asked.
Near my village, on the west bank of the Nidwalden River. Dahlgren is very small and only has been there a short time. It's in the new province of Westbank in Dunmore.
I've heard about that place. It's supposedly being attacked by elven raiders.
Oh, it's not the elves. The elves have never caused us any trouble.
I knew it, Royce said to no one in particular.
Leastways, I don't think so,
Thrace went on.
We think it's a beast of some kind. No one has ever seen it. Deacon Thomas says it's a demon, a minion of Uberlin.
And your father? Hadrian asked. How does he fit into this?
He's going to try and kill the beast, only...
She faltered and looked at her feet once more.
Only you think it'll kill him instead.
It's killed 15 people and over 80 head of livestock.
A freckle-faced woman with wild red hair entered the parlour, dragging a short, pot-bellied man who looked like he had shaved for the occasion, his face nicked raw. The woman was laughing, walking backward as she hauled him along with both hands. The man stopped short when he saw them. His hands slipped through hers, and she fell to the wooden floor with a hollow thud. The man looked from the woman to them and back, frozen in place. The woman glanced over her shoulder and laughed.
Oops, was all she could manage. Didn't know it was taken. Give us a hand up, Rubus.
The man helped her to her feet. She paused to give Thrace a long, appraising look, then winked at them.
We do good work, don't we? That was Maggie,
Thrace told them after the woman hauled her man back out again. Hadrian moved to the sofa and gestured for Thrace to sit. She sat gingerly and straight, not allowing her back to touch the rear of the sofa, and carefully smoothed out her skirt. Royce remained on his feet.
Does Westbank have a lord? Why isn't he doing something about this?
We had a fine margrave, she said. A brave man with three good knights.
Had?
He and his knights rode out to fight the beast one evening. Later, all that was found was bits and pieces of armour.
Why don't you just leave? Royce asked.
Thrace's head drooped and her shoulders slouched a bit. Two nights before I left to come here, the beast killed everyone in my family except for me and my father. We weren't home. My father had worked late in the fields, and I went to look for him. I accidentally left the door open. Light attracts it. It went right for our house. My brother, Thad, his wife, and their son were all killed. Thad. He was the joy of my father's life. He was the reason we moved to Dahlgren in the first place, so he could become the town's first cooper.
Tears welled in her eyes.
Now they're all gone. My father has nothing left but his grief and the beast that brought it. He'll see it dead or die himself before the month is out. If I'd only closed the door. If I had just checked the latch.
Her hands covered her face, and her slender body quivered. Royce gave Hadrian a stern look, shaking his head very slightly,
and mouthing the word no. Hadrian scowled and placed his hand on her shoulder and brushed the hair away from her eyes.
"You're going to ruin all your pretty makeup," he said.
"I'm sorry. I really don't want to be such a bother. These aren't your problems. It's just that my father is all I have left, and I can't bear the thought of losing him, too. I can't reason with him. I asked him to leave, but he won't listen."
"I can see your problem, but why us?" Royce asked coldly. "And how does a farmer's daughter from the frontier know our names, and how to find us in Colnora?"
"A crippled man told me. He sent me here. He said you could open the tower."
"A cripple?"
"Yes. Mr. Harden told me the beast can't—"
"Mr. Harden?" Royce interrupted.
"Uh-huh."
"This Mr. Harden, he wouldn't be missing his hands, would he?"
"Yes, that's him."
Royce and Hadrian exchanged glances.
"What exactly did he say?"
"He said the beast can't be harmed by weapons made by man, but inside Avamparthe there's a sword that can kill it."
"So, a man with no hands told you to find us in Colnora and hire us to get a sword for your father from a tower called Avamparthe?" Royce asked. The girl nodded. Hadrian looked at his partner.
"Don't tell me. It's a dwarven tower."
"No," Royce replied. "It's elvish." He turned away with a thoughtful expression. Hadrian returned his attention to the girl. He felt awful. It was bad enough that her village was so far away, but now they faced an elven tower. Even if she offered them 100 gold tenants, he wouldn't be able to convince Royce to take the job. She was so desperate, so in need of help. His stomach knotted as he considered the words he would say next.
"Well," Hadrian began reluctantly, "the Nidwalden River is several days' travel over rough ground. We'd need to get supplies for, what, a 6-7-day trip? That's 2 weeks there and 2 weeks back. We'd need food and grain for the horses. Then you'd have to add in time at the tower. That's time we could be doing other jobs, so that right there is money lost. Then there's the danger involved. Risk of any kind can bump our price, and a mass-murdering phantom demon beast that can't be harmed by weapons has got to be classified as a risk."
Hadrian looked into her eyes and shook his head.
"I hate to say it, and I'm very sorry, but we can't take your money," Royce abruptly interjected as he spun around. "It's too much. To take the full 25 silver for this job. 10 really seems more than enough."
Hadrian raised an eyebrow and stared at his partner but said nothing.
10 silver each?
No, Hadrian replied, keeping his eyes on Royce. "That would be together, right? 5 each.
Roy shrugged. "Since I'll be doing the actual lock-picking, I think I should get 6, but we can work that out between us. It's not something she needs to be concerned about."
"Really?"
Thrace asked, looking as if she might explode with happiness.
"Sure," Royce replied. "After all, we're not thieves."
"Want to explain why we're taking this job?"
Hadrian asked, shielding his eyes as they stepped outside. The sky was a perfect blue, the morning sun already working to dry the lingering puddles from the night before. All around them people rushed to market. Carts loaded with spring vegetables and tarp-covered barrels sat trapped behind 3 wagons mounded high with hay. Out of the crowd in front of them, a fat man charged forward with a flapping chicken gripped tightly under each arm. He danced around the puddles, dodging people and carts and offering a muttered, "Excuse me," as he pressed by.
"She's paying us 10 silver for a job that has already cost us a gold tenant," Hadrian continued after successfully skirting the chicken man. "It'll cost us several more before we're done."
We're not doing it for the money, Royce informed him as he cut a path through the crowd.
Obviously. But why are we doing it? I mean, sure, she's cute as a button and all, but unless you're planning on selling her, I don't see the angle here.
Royce looked over his shoulder, displaying an evil grin. I never even considered selling her. That could defray the costs considerably.
Forget I brought it up. Just tell me why we're doing this.
Royce led them out of the crowd toward Ognaton's curio shop, whose window exhibited hookahs, porcelain animal figurines, and jewellery boxes with brass latches. They ducked around the side into the narrow bricked space between it and a confectioner's shop that was offering free samples of hard candy.
"Don't tell me you haven't wondered what Ezra Harden has been doing," Royce whispered.
"That wizard was imprisoned for 900 years, then disappears the day we break him out, and we don't hear a word about him until now. The church must know, and yet the Imperialists haven't launched search parties or posted notices. I would think that if the most dangerous man alive was on the loose, there might be a bit more of a commotion. 2 years later, he turns up in a tiny village and invites us to come visit. On top of that, he picks the Elfin Frontier and Avum Partha as the meeting place. Don't you want to find out what he wants?
What is Avum Partha?
All I know is that it's old, real old, some kind of ancient elven citadel. Which also begs the question, wouldn't you like to get a peek inside? If Ezra Harden thinks there's value in opening it, I'm guessing he's right.
So, we're going after ancient elven treasure?
I have no idea, but I'm sure there is something valuable in there.
But for that we need supplies, and we need to get out of town before Price lets loose the hounds.
Well, as long as you promise not to sell the girl.
I won't, if she behaves herself.
Hadrian felt Thrace leaning again, this time gazing at a two-story country home of stucco and stone with a yellow thatch roof and orange clay chimney. It was surrounded by a waist-high wall overgrown with lilacs and ivy.
"It's so beautiful," she whispered.
It was early afternoon, and they were only a few miles out of Colnora, travelling east along the Alburn Road. The country lane twisted through the tangle of tiny villages that comprised the hill region surrounding the city, little hamlets where poor farmers worked their fields alongside the summer cottages of the idle rich, who, for 3 months a year, pretended to be country squires. Royce rode beside them or trotted forward as congestion demanded. His hood was up despite the pleasant weather. Thrace rode behind Hadrian on his bay mare. Her legs dangled off one side, bobbing to the rhythm of the horse's stride.
"It's a different world here," she said. "A paradise, really. Everyone is wealthy. Everyone a king."
"Colnora does all right, but I wouldn't go that far."
"Then how do you explain all the grand houses? The horse carts have metal rims on their wheels. The vegetable stands overflow with bushels of onions and green peas. And Dahlgren, all we have are footpaths, and they're an awful mess after a rain. And here you have such wide roads, and they even have names on posts. And back there, a farmer was wearing gloves. Gloves on his hands, while working. In Dahlgren, even the church deacon doesn't own fancy gloves, and he certainly wouldn't work in them if he did. You are all so rich."
"Some of them are."
"Like you two."
Hadrian laughed.
"But you have nice clothes and beautiful horses." "She's not much of a horse, really.
No one in Dahlgren but the Lord and his knights own horses. And yours are so pretty. I especially like her eyes. Such long lashes. What's her name?"
"I call her Millie, after a woman I once knew who had the same habit of not listening to me."
"Millie is a pretty name. I like it. What about Royce's horse?"
Hadrian frowned and looked over at him.
"I don't know. Royce, did you ever name her?"
"What for?"
Hadrian glanced back at Thrace, who returned an appalled look.
"How about—"
She paused, shifting and twisting as she scanned the roadside.
"Lilac or Daisy. Oh, wait!
No, how about chrysanthemum?
Chrysanthemum?
Hadrian repeated. As funny as it might be to have Royce riding a chrysanthemum, or even a lilac or daisy, he had to point out that flower names just didn't fit Royce's short, dirty grey mare.
How about Shorty? Or Sooty?
No,
Race scolded him. It'll make the poor animal feel awful.
Hadrian chuckled. Royce ignored the conversation. He clicked his tongue, kicked the sides of his horse, and trotted forward to avoid an approaching wagon, but he remained there even after the road was clear.
How about Lady?
Thrace asked. Seems a bit haughty, don't you think? She's not exactly a prancing show horse.
Then it'll make her feel better. Give her confidence.
They were coming upon a stream where honeysuckle and raspberry bushes crowned the heads of smooth granite banks with brilliant springtime green. A gristmill stood at the edge, its great wheel creaking and dripping. A pair of small square windows like dark eyes created a face in the stone exterior beneath the steeply peaked wooden roof. A low wall separated the mill from the road, and on it rested a white and grey cat. Its green eyes opened lazily and blinked at them. When they drew closer, the cat decided they had come close enough and leapt from the wall, darting across the road into the thickets.
Royce's horse reared and whinnied, dancing across the dirt. As the horse shuffled backward, Royce cursed and tightened the reins, pulling her head down and forcing her to turn completely around. Ridiculous, Royce complained once the horse was under control. A 1,000-pound animal terrified by a 5-pound cat. You'd think she was a mouse.
Mouse! That's perfect,
Thrace shouted, causing Millie's ears to twist back.
I like it, Hadrian agreed. Oh, good Lord, Royce muttered, shaking his head as he trotted forward again.
As they rode farther east, the country estates became farms, rose bushes became hedges, and fences that divided fields gave way to mere tree lines. Still, Thrace pointed out curiosities, like the unimagined luxury of covered bridges and the ornately decorated carriages that still occasionally thundered by. The road climbed higher, and soon they lost the shade as the land opened up into vast fallow fields of goldenrod, milkweed, and wild salafan. Flies dogged them in the heat, and the drone of cicadas whined. Thrace at last grew quiet and laid her head against Hadrian's back. He became concerned she might fall asleep and topple off, but occasionally she would stir to look about or swat at a fly. Higher and higher they climbed, until they reached the top of Amber Heights. The prominent highland stood out as a bald spot of short grass and bare rock. Part of a long ridge that ran along the eastern edge of Warwick, it served as the border between the Kingdom of Warwick and the Kingdom of Ulburn. Ulburn was the third most powerful and prosperous kingdom in Avon, after Warwick and Melengar. Most of its lands were deeply forested, and its coast was often subjected to attacks by the Baran Gazelle, who made lightning assaults, abducting the unfortunate and burning what they couldn't carry. Its ruler, King Armand, had only recently gained the throne after the unexpected death of the old king. While King Reinhold had been a royalist, Hadrian had the impression the new king was an imperialist sympathizer, if not an open supporter, which was unfortunate for Melengar, whose list of allies seemed to grow shorter each day. Amber Heights was a curiosity even to the local residents due to the standing stones, the massive blue-grey rocks carved into uniquely fluid shapes. They appeared almost organic in their rounded curves, like a series of writhing serpents burrowing in and out of the hilltop. Hadrian didn't have the slightest idea what purpose the stones might have originally served. He doubted anyone did. Remnants of campfires were scattered around the stones, etched with messages of true love or the occasional slogan, "Maribor is God," "Nationalists are balmy," "The air is dead," and even, "Grey Mouse Tavern, it's all downhill from here."
Reaching the crest, they could all see the city of Kolnora spread out behind them, while to the northeast lay the endless miles of dense and untamed woodland where the